Well, I wondered what this would be like. Okay. Hi, everybody. My name's Elizabeth. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Hi. Hi. Okay. Well, I made some notes. Okay. Yes. But they're just the things I don't want to forget. Okay. So let's see. My sobriety date is August 15th, 1984. And I just celebrated 40 years this past summer. I never thought that would happen. So I got sober. Let me see. When was that? At the beginning? The very beginning, right? What happened? What it was like? What happened? What it's like now, right? So there was no alcoholics in my family, but my mother's from Greece, and you know, I don't know if you know about Zorba the Greek. Anyone seen that movie? Okay. So that's what we did. We drank wine. We made wine. And we ate a lot of garlic. Anyway, they didn't abuse alcohol, and I have no idea how it all started. But I got into high school in 1963. Probably some of you weren't even born. And it was the hippie era just starting. And I discovered that I could be a free spirit really easily if I took the right drug or drank the right thing. So I did that, and I enjoyed myself immensely for several years. So let's see, I grew up in Connecticut. It's a Norman Rockwell state. Everything is very conservative there, so I had to leave. And I went to Texas, Austin, Texas, and I had a short marriage. We got married, I was 19, and we said as long as it was gonna work, and it only worked for a year, but it did get me to Texas. And so I really enjoyed the music scene, and it was pretty wild. Austin was a really fun place then. I guess it still is, but I'm sure it's a lot more expensive than it was when I was there. I rented a place. I went to the University of Texas in Austin, and I think we paid $75 a month. And it was three bedrooms with a big deck. And, oh, God, what a life, huh? So I got busted there, and I exchanged my etchings for the lawyer to get me off, and that was my first arrest. Not a real serious thing, but we did buy drugs from a narc, you know. Give it to me, you know. So, and I had, I lived in a commune, and we were all pretty nuts, you know. Like we went out and picked peyote buttons and made spaghetti sauce, you know, and proceeded to eat the spaghetti, and then, you know, all hell broke loose. So I stayed there a few years, and I didn't like the artwork. Oh, I forgot to tell you, I'm an artist, right? That's a big part of my story, because I always identified with that. And, you know, that was from the third grade. So I knew in the third grade what I was going to do in life. And my teacher was Mr. Urbanati. I still remember him. And, so in Texas, all they drew were cowboys and armadillos and stuff like that, you know, and I didn't fit in. So I was there for a few years. My ex-husband, we all lived in the same commune. God, that was uncomfortable. You know, what an impossible thing to think you could do, you know, somebody you're married to, then you're going to live in a commune and you're going to watch them, you know, going out with other people in the next room. You know, stuff like that. So let me see, what year was it? I moved across the country, and my brother, who was a hash oil producer, I am going to be talking about drugs, he gave me a whole big bottle of hash oil, and I made cookies. So then, this is that story. I met a woman in Houston for a week. We bought a car, and we decided to drive to California together, and she had a dog. And we're driving across the country, and the dog ate the cookies. Yeah, So then we had to ambulate the dog every hour, you know, so that it wouldn't die. It didn't die. And we drove to San Francisco. And we got to, I think it was Bakersfield, and we saw these two cute guys hitchhiking, you know. So we decided, oh, let's pick them up. And they sat in the back seat, and they had a satchel between them. And it was full of money and jewelry. They had just robbed a jewelry store. So it's like, you know, one of my friends said when I got sober, she goes, it's like the fall of Calamity Jane. You know, it's like, I mean, it just messes upon messes, but we always got out of them anyway. Anyway, we got to San Francisco, and she left right away. And I met these guys and lived off of Haight Street. He did what's it called? It's Rolfing. Do you know what Rolfing is? It's very painful, very painful. And it actually changed me, you know. But so he was a Rolfer, and I was trying to find a job, and I was going to different places. And I met the biggest pot dealer in San Francisco, Dennis Perrone, and started working for him in his restaurants. And I became a baker. So my first job out of college was something that my mother taught me when I was like in the fifth grade. And I did that for a series of years. Okay, now where are we at? I have to compose myself. I was thinking about when I was sober, I used to go to family reunions and they're in New York State. And everybody would meet at this park on Cuyuca Lake by the Finger Lakes, beautiful place. And they would all bring their dishes, and each family would sit with their own nuclear family and eat their own food. And it was a family reunion, right? You know, it's like, what are we doing? We're not talking to each other. We're not moving around, you know. So I would start, you know, being a little shit disturber, going around and, you know, talking to each person and then saying, can I have some of that? You know, like eating some of their food and changing it around. And I was wondering about that when we were all sitting here, you know, if everybody was sitting next to somebody they knew, would they want to get up and sit next to somebody that they didn't know? Okay, no. That's all right. You know, I became a middle school art teacher, and I used to order kids around, so you're not kids, you know. All right, so anyway, back to, where was I, San Francisco? Yeah, I had a good time there. I didn't know about gay. I didn't know anything about it when I got there. So I went to Maud's, which is a big gay bar off of Haight Street, and all these women were buying me drinks, and I was going, wow, I'm so popular. What is this, you know? And I found out about that, and I found out about how to have a really good time dancing in bars with a lot of gay guys. And when I got sober, I saw half of them in the meetings, so it was all right. But alcohol started to have its way, you know, and that's what happens with us, right? I mean, I heard someone say, you know, I didn't burn the toast and decide to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. It really got miserable. The drugs took me down first, cocaine. And I think I went to my first meeting in 1981. And that's because a group of people that I drank and used with, this Irish Catholic family, there were five kids, and we were all terrors. I mean, absolutely, you know. And we got in so much shit together. And they did an intervention on their mother. And out of that, three of us got sober. She didn't. But we did. So that's how I heard about my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to, in behind Haight-Ashbury in a church, it was a meditation meeting, I think. It was the Artists and Writers, that's right. It's still there, it's still going on. And I said, I think I'm doing research on alcoholism. And I'm wondering, you know, if I'm an alcoholic, you know, like that. You know, I was just so egotistical. And when they mentioned God, I had to leave. So I let that hold me for another 3 years. And then, as usual, the worst came, you know, and I mean, I had, I was a tweaker, really, you know, I loved cocaine, and I was like a little teeny size, you know, and I had I lived in a warehouse space on 17th in Mississippi, and there was a manhole cover outside that, in that four-corner intersection that went click, 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 you know, and of course, when you're up all night and you're very busy, you know, you have to go out and fix it. So I got I had a hammer and a bunch of shims, and I went out there in a nightie in the middle, you know, wedging the manhole cover so it would stop clicking, you know. And years later, I'm sober, and my sponsor and I go by that same, and it's still doing it. It's still doing it. I bet it's still doing it. Anyway, so it all came to an end in 1984. And I decided to go into the Women's Alcoholism Center, and I signed a contract with them. And this was very helpful for anyone. Is there anyone really new here tonight? No? Okay. So this was helpful because I didn't have to wonder about what I could use or take, you know, and they had me very thoroughly watched, and I had to report all my things, like allergy medicines and everything. And one of my friends that I made up there, you know, she got kicked out because of her cough medicine, you know, but she knew it, right? You know, so anyway, it was a great, I did an interview there to get in with a woman named Dee, who after a little while met in Pacifica. But I said, how do I know I'm an alcoholic? And she goes, well, you could have a liver biopsy. Well, here I am, you know, unemployed with no health care, going, maybe I should do that, you know. What does that involve, you know, a liver biopsy? So, I mean, I just didn't believe I could be an alcoholic because my parents weren't, you know, nobody drank. My mother had a liquor cabinet over her stove, and there was dust on the bottles. I mean, you know, it was there forever. You know, and only when I came home, I cleaned it out. You know, but so, yeah, she never forgave me. I drank her bottle of ouzo from Greece. I had to fill it up with water with a little sugar so that she could be content looking at it, thinking it was still ouzo. Anyway, so I had my interview, and I went into the Women's Alcoholism Center, and it answered a lot of questions, you know, because instead of food, I wanted booze, you know. Instead of, you know, going out for a walk, I wanted to get loaded and isolate. You know, I lived at that time in a 3,000 square foot loft space, you know, a really an artist kind of wet dream. And by the end of my drinking, I didn't leave a 10 by 10 foot area with a nose to the mirror and, you know, booze. And I was in a union, the Teamsters Union, for Local 510. It's a movable interiors. We did exhibits. So I was in that union at the time, and you couldn't get fired. I mean, I don't know what, you know, how you get fired out of the Teamsters. Well, we know on their story, right? I mean, it's pretty hard. But they would call me for work. And if I didn't want to, I just didn't go, you know. But I made a bad mistake one day, and when I was completely loaded, I answered the phone. And I knew the dispatcher, you know, and he goes, are you okay? And I'm like, sure, fine, you know. What do you think, you know? So when I got sober, I went to work, and the Teamsters were very supportive. They know about alcoholism, you know. There's a whole bunch of drunks at that union. That's what it was at. In fact, drugs was a really big part of it because you had to stay up all night to work on booze so that the show would open in the morning, and everybody was always, you know, doing things to help them stay up. So let me see. So I got on the union. It's a long time ago, you know it? 40 years. I mean, Jesus, you know, I can't think about what I did last week. Okay. So I was 50 years old, setting booths in the union and looking around at, you know, dragging around 12-foot ladders, climbing, hauling. We built big booths. I loved it. I mean, you know, because I make sculpture. So we'd have like a double-decker steel girder boost, you know, with drift pins like this, you know. You know, line up the girders, you know, and then the guy comes with the forklift and you go up on the lift and put the pins in and, you know, you build these big things and then you get to take them down at the end of the show. So I knew that as a woman, I wasn't going to be able to do this forever, you know, so I'm like, I think I was like 3 years sober. How long? I got sober in 84. Now I went back to school in 1990. So in the middle of that, I met somebody who was a good model for going back to school and recovering your life. And he had been just let out of San Quentin, and he had a scholarship, yeah, to go to state. And I thought, well, you know, shit, if he can go, I can go, you know. So I decided to go back to school and change my career. And that was a major accomplishment. I don't know who else has had to do that in sobriety, but it's pretty tricky because, you know, you have 20 years of one life, and then you start, that's where my notes will come in handy here. I was able to follow what I've been learning in the program and the steps and learn about how to take a test and negotiate classes and work a little and support myself and actually, you know, work my way through a program. So, you know, I had said originally in my first resume, which I used for many years, that I went to Yale and got a master's. Not true, okay? So in 1980, I don't know what year it was 92 or something like that, I actually went back to state and did get a master's. And that was quite an accomplishment. And so I think that's what we can do here, you know. I reclaimed what I wanted to do with my life, and I started figuring out where I wanted it to go instead of just harem scarum, you know, like you're in the desert with a bunch of people doing drugs and, you know, you stay there for a year. I mean, you know, stuff like that was where I was before I got organized in my brain. Okay, I need to really make some look at some notes. So that was a really good place to be in that time period because I loved being a student and I liked learning. And I was able to, you know, when you go to state as an elder statesman, let's say, you have to get A's on everything. And I'm with undergraduates, you know, so I put all this fucking pressure on these undergraduates. They're like, we gotta do good on this project because I have to get an A because it doesn't count for my degree, you know, and stuff like that. Because the classes are impacted. And it was just so much fun to be a part of it all. So I got a master's, and then what? You know, it took me 3 years to get a job. And that was really discouraging. And I applied to all the top universities. You know, I really thought, big, important, you know. And I didn't get any responses. So there's this old fart in Pacifica in the program, you know, we always get our references, our suggestions from the elders. And he goes, Elizabeth, you have to lower your expectations. And I was like, oh, how insulting. But you know what? I did, and I started getting work. I started working in artisan residency programs and school recreation programs, and I was teaching like kindergartners in like Palo Alto, you know. Or one of them was actually on the Stanford campus, you know. Those are little rich kids, you know, really, but clever. One goes to the other one, do you have a, are you ADHD? He's five. Asking the other one in the class. And then I discovered that they eat the paper mache paste. And, you know, you can't give them that. So anyway, I was not a good person with little people, you know. I didn't get it, you know. I'd go, do you know how to read? You know, because I was giving them a syllabus, you know. So I know. So I didn't last too long there, but I got enough collected resume to get a really good job. And I got, I started at San Francisco State teaching, the worst job I ever had. You don't want to be an adjunct professor, by the way, no. So I went to a private school, and they treated me really well, and I really did well there. And the kids were privileged, but very special and dedicated. And they really wanted to learn, and that's the best place to teach, right? You know, you don't have to convince them. Because I had a few other harrowing experiences with, you know, schools with cyclone wire around them, stuff like that. And that's hard to deal with. So I taught there for the next 15 years or so. And I haven't talked about relationships. Okay. I'm not good at relationships. I never had any, and I was... I was like 50. Yeah, I was 50, and I had never had a long-term relationship. I had many short-term relationships of 24 hours or so, you know, but that was it, yeah. So that person that taught me about how to go to school, I fell madly in love with, and but we didn't live together. So the trick was, we had a week, this is the best way to have a relationship, by the way, weekends. Every weekend, you get together. And in the middle, and then the work week, you go to work and you do your thing, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, so he came over and he said he was going to retire and move up here. And would I want to go? And I said, yes. Not thinking about, we're going to live together. We're going to leave the coast. We're going to come to a place with fire and snow. And what else? You know, conservative culturally. And so anyway, so I moved up here and retired out of that teaching job in 2017, I think, or 18. Yeah, 2018. And it took me a while, I got to say, you know. And you know what? I have fallen in love with all of you guys. I really have. I love it here now. I've made friends. In AA in Pacifica, I had like 35 years or something, and up here, you know, I have whatever now. And it's just AA rules. It runs everything. It's a perfect world when I follow the program. So what I was going to talk about was I can trust it. I trust that whenever I'm disturbed, I can find a solution in the program. I just use the steps, I call people, I do the work. How long am I supposed to talk? It's only been 22 minutes. All right. You know, I just, it was amazing to find all the gifts in sobriety and to keep finding them. They don't. It just doesn't stop. I didn't know how to love anybody. I didn't think I was able to do that. I don't know why, because my parents really loved me very much and unconditionally. You know, they took all my bullshit that I gave and still loved me. They never judged me. You know, but for some reason, I didn't feel like I was capable of it, and that's what I've been learning in the program. And when I think about a higher power, I think about God as an action of love. So it's not a thing, it's not a being, it's not a idea alone. It's an action that I have to demonstrate. And I'm thinking about a book I read called Conversations with God. I don't know if anyone's read it, but the premise of the book is that everybody is in heaven, and we are doing fine, and we're all united, and love is the energy that flows through. I mean, it's a utopia. Then one guy goes, I want to see what it's like outside. I'm going to go, and when I come back, you have to promise that you recognize me and identify me as a child of God or the universe or creation, something like that. So I think that's what my job is here, is to recognize that being in each of you and every minute that I look in your face. So that I think that's what our jobs are as people. And if we did that, we would all love each other. And that would be pretty darn nice, wouldn't it? I'm still a hippie.
Yeah.
I had a good time as a hippie. It was a wonderful life. You know, I mean, it was full of possibilities and dreams, and I thought I could do anything, be anything, but I didn't know how to love, you know. All right, so there's that. What's next? Oh, general service. I was reviewing my general service manual for this talk. Yes. Well, I tell you why. It's amazing. I was GSR up here. And I went to conferences, and you know, when I got sober in Pacifica, I did some GSR also. And some of the same people, like 25 years later, they're still doing general service, you know. So it fits for those who it fits, you know, and they stay, and they really are helpful to our program, because if without them, we wouldn't have it, you know. But I was going to talk about substantial unanimity, the idea that in the third legacy of GSR program, when you vote, everybody votes, and if there's a dissenting vote, they get to say their piece. It's called, what's it called?
Minority opinion.
And then when they, after they share their differences, you vote again. And oftentimes, the entire vote changes the balance. It changes the whole direction, and the agenda changes because of that minority opinion. I mean, it's like the most fair and equal, honorable form of government that I've ever heard of, you know? And if this country could adopt it, it would be great. But, you know, okay, we're not going to go there. But I love general service, and I believe that everybody should try to do it at least once in your life. I tried it when I was a year sober, and I was throwing spitballs in the meeting, so I don't think I was mature enough then. But later on, I could do it. So, you know, it's just really great. Let me see. I read The Keys to the Kingdom. I love that part of the big book. And she talks, it's Marty Mann, who was one of the first women in AA. She says, it's not a plan for recovery that can be finished. It's a way of life and a challenge, and our principles is great enough to keep every human being striving for the rest of their lives. Others may idle in retrogressive grooves. It's not a good groove. Retrogressive means you're sitting in your own doo-doo, you know, or you're not going anywhere. You know, really, you know, it's kind of like move forward or don't. And it's dangerous for us, I believe, to not grow. So her antidote for staying out of the retrogressive groove is gratitude. And that's so powerful. So, you know, I picked a sponsor up here. I had the same sponsor for 35 years. Oh, I was just brokenhearted when she died. It was hard. You know, really connected with her. She drove a Harley. Yeah. Okay. So, but she took me to all these spiritual programs and different teachers, you know, and we studied Sufism and Kabbalah and Royal Order of Christ the King. I bet you've never heard of that one. And, I mean, just some really far-out stuff, you know. So I became a minister or a priest of my own life. I decided I would recognize my spirituality through myself and not some guy in a church that I didn't really know. And it was very interesting to do. And the practices were pretty rigorous, and we meditated like 2 or 3 times a day. We had calling it meditation with the masters. You had to get up at 5 a.m. That was hard. But anyway, her name was Sandy, and I was with her for a very long time. And she helped me get married, and she helped me get divorced when it was time to get divorced. Oh, I forgot to tell you about that one. That was an early AA marriage again. And I'll never forget, you know, I was miserable in that marriage, and I went out to my studio and I just said, he won't leave. And she goes, go in, go back in the house, tell him he has to be out in 30 days. 30 days, and come back here and call me and tell me you did it. And I did, and it worked, and he left. And then I met Art. Okay. So, I know. Whatever. When it works, it really works. And I had to work very hard at that marriage, but I don't have to work at this one. It's kind of like when I'm going in the right direction, I know it's the right direction because I don't meet a lot of resistance. And if I meet resistance and I get bullheaded and headstrong, I just get myself in deep shit. So I have to listen to what's going on. And that's how I negotiate or navigate through my life, really, you know. It's like I can make important decisions ahead of time and then go there and think, oh, this is a terrible mistake, you know. And thank God I can say that and turn around and go, I can't do this. It's not right. That's how we learn. So the process of growing is a job. It's a job here, you know, and I take it pretty seriously. I'm talking about gratitude. So gratitude, she said, gratitude makes us toe the line. I mean, we came together fearful and out of necessity. We find we are more than compensated for a consistent effort and love of life, friendship, mutual trust. We live a higher quality of life with no strings attached. Just stay and don't drink. And that's what she wrote about, you know. It's beautiful. I think we should read this at meetings instead of more about alcoholism. I'm sick of that. At our 6 o'clock meeting on Friday, I go, oh, I cut that short. Oh, no, you know. Okay. I know, God. So, what else have I got here? Oh, language of the heart. So I was secretary of a meeting online. It's great, you know, since COVID, we have Zoom, and I've been able to connect with the women I got sober with in San Francisco and in Pacifica. And we meet on Thursday nights, and it's a women's 10 years plus, but anybody, any woman can come. We'll let anyone in. But I was the secretary, and you find readings, and we read those and discuss them at the meeting, which I really like too, because then you don't get into the daily, the chores or the things that went wrong in your day or the same reports from the same people, especially in small communities. It's a good idea. Okay, so language of the heart. I read about Bill W.'s right kind of acceptance and how we get there. And I said, grinding off the edges that keep me from seeing solutions is what I usually do, which is, you know, like sandpaper on the skin. It could be painful, you know, to figure out why I am not seeing a solution. No, just see the solution. So what are the obstacles in front of me that I'm seeing that are distracting me from answers to where I'm at? Because my belief is, if I have a problem, the answer is out here. No one is hiding things from me. You know, it's transparent. I can see it if the obstacles to have been removed. And basically, they're obstacles to love. So I make a decision to start in a certain direction. Then I evaluate how it's going. Stop. Then I go, if I'm feeling open and it's smooth and it's easy, keep going. If I start getting uptight, stop. And it's like that, you know. It's hard to follow me on the freeway, you know, but it's okay if you're driving. Yeah. All right. So Father Tom talks about standing in front of a wall. You know, you got to go left or right. You just can't stand there, you know. So we have to make decisions in life, and it's hard, you know, some of them. But you could be like me and just don't even think about it and just move up here with Art. That's it, you know. I mean, I just love the guy. So I went, okay, you know, and it's really, it's working out. All right. Gee, I'm winding down. What else? Oh, the Serenity Prayer. So that's the most powerful prayer, I think, and I use it all the time. And I have to keep remembering that at first, the first part of it is I need to get serene before I can figure anything out. Instead of, okay, I'm gonna get this. You know, I have this bulldog, you know, mentality that I'm just gonna get it, you know. And I have to wait and see, so I have to learn to meditate. So I took TM, I took a class in TM, it's fun. I have meditated before, but now I have several, regular kind of dependable repeating prayers. And the repeating part is what's comforting to me, you know, that I say it over and over. I read a book called The Jesus Prayer. I don't know if anyone has recognized that. Sherry did. Sherry, who passed away, if you remember her. When she read that book, she came into the meeting and she was telling me about it. And I was like, yes, you know. It's a story of a monk in Russia in the 12th century or something who wanted to learn to pray unceasingly. And he went around with an empty bowl, you know, praying and saying the Jesus Prayer. And he got it to where it was actually beating his heart. It was a repetition, moving his blood flow, his breath, his heartbeat. That's a little far-fetched, you know, but it's possible to get it so ingrained that you don't even realize you're saying it. So I did a couple of AIDS rides, and I rode my bike like 750 miles, and it was very handy to have a repeating prayer, because your ass hurts so much that you need to get your mind off of it, you know, so it worked. That was really fun, too, by the way. So anyway, the Jesus Prayer, I don't even necessarily think about it as being about Jesus. I think about it as being an energy force. In Greece, they have this thing they call an egregore. It's a belief system like the cloud. We all know about the cloud, right? Right? The cloud? You know, like Apple's cloud, you store your stuff in the cloud. Okay, yeah. So, but in Greece they have, it's like when a lot of people for centuries say the same prayer, it creates a force and an energy field. And I believe that. So believing it, it helps me to tie into it to say that ancient prayer. No matter what my thoughts are about the Jesus person or, you know, the particular religion, it's just the practice of it. And I like the practices that repeat. So that's why I like meetings so much, you know. But I still don't like more about alcoholism. All right. So I think, you know, this is quite a lot. What else? I don't know what else to talk about. Did I tell you about the hooker's ball? No. Oh, well, it's back to my drinking days. Margot, what was her name? She was a prostitute in San Francisco that had this big ball, hooker's ball, and I had to go. And it was like, I don't know, I got there at 73, so it was probably not much longer than that, but I had on a garter belt, a strapless bra, a little fox thing, little fur, and I took a cab to downtown San Francisco by the ferry building. We had a big, there was all the, I think they weren't all prostitutes, because I wasn't one, but anyway, it was a big ball, and we all went, and it was very risque, to say the least. So somebody stole my fox fur and my purse. So I had to get home. I managed to get the bus without any money because I had on a strapless bra and a garter belt, and that was it. And I took the bus home. So those are some of the dilemmas that drinking can get you into. Yeah, I'm telling you, it was really crazy. It's like, growing up, being there with pre-AIDS, you know, in San Francisco was really fun. And then when AIDS hit, it was really terrible, you know. And that first couple of years of my sobriety, I lost like probably 20 guys, you know, from my meetings. So anyway, I know I was still getting sober, you know, and I went to my friend Charles, who was dying of AIDS, and I was like, how can you not drink? And he goes, believe me, that's the last thing on my mind. You know, it's like, and I couldn't get it. I was like, not drinking is the biggest problem, you know, that I would have to face, never mind dying from AIDS. Okay, I'm going all over the board now. So, it's been a privilege to speak here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not live without it. I trust it. I go to it for everything. I feel sorry for people who are not alcoholics when I never used to think that, you know. I used to think, are you kidding me? You know. But really now, I wish everybody had a program for living, you know, that we do. Because anything I've had to face, I mean, I built a building without a permit in Pacifica because I found people in the program who told me how to do it, you know? I mean, and both my parents died, and I found people to show me how to get through that. I got married, got divorced, showed me how to get through that, you know? So now I'm getting older, and I've become somewhat decrepit, and that's hard to face. And so, you know, I'm looking to people to show me how to get through this, you know, and it's just amazing to grow up and then grow old in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never thought I would be 76. I mean, goddamn, you know. But I am. So I think I'm going to close. Do you want to say the third step prayer or something? Huh? What? More about alcoholism. I don't want to hear it. It's like, oh, God. So many things. Well, how many of you did all those things? You know? Yeah? Okay. You can share about that. That could be our discussion. Do we want to have a little discussion, or are we just going to close?
It's your meeting.
It's my meeting. Okay, so let's hear more about alcoholism, what you did that's in it. I want to hear, you know, all the creative ways. Like, when I was married to Larry, he worked at United Airlines, and there was a guy, really bad alcoholic, who was trying to get sober. And he would take his drinks and put them in the backyard, bury it with a straw. And then he'd be out there. I'm just getting sun, dear, you know, sipping on the straw. I mean, it was such a great length to go to, you know, to hide it from your wife, you know. And I know another guy who I did hospitals and institutions with, and he had a lot of years. This is a sad story. And then he went out, and he had like, I don't know, 3 or 4 six-packs, a couple of bottles. And he hit him in the garage. His wife was in the program too, okay? And his first thought, this is what he said before he had a drink, this is not enough. I don't have enough alcohol, you know? And I don't know if he made it back, you know? That's the scary part. I haven't had a slip. You know, if we're here, you just better fucking stay here, you know? Because you just have no idea if you're going to make it back. And nobody knows that. So, you know, that might be the message for tonight. Thank you. All right.